Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm Tommy Vitor.
On today's show, little Ronnie Pudding Fingers finally responds to Trump's attacks and quietly signs a six-week abortion ban in Florida. Kevin McCarthy has a new debt ceiling plan that's probably dead on arrival.
You know, he may not have wanted to sign it, but his fingerprints were all over it. Pudding. Putting fingers.
The proof. No.
Yep.
The Democrats' Dianne Feinstein problem is not going away, and neither are Clarence Thomas's ethics scandals. Then we talked to Crooked's own Max Fisher about the epic defamation case that's set to begin this week between Fox News and Dominion Voting Systems. All right, let's get to the news. The Republican presidential primary starting to give off some 2016 vibes. Donald Trump has been attacking Ron DeSantis as a grandma-killing, establishment rhino pedophile for weeks now.
That tracks, yeah.
But it was this MAGA super PAC ad that finally prompted DeSantis's ironically named Never Back Down super PAC to respond.
Ron DeSantis loves sticking his fingers where they don't belong. And we're not just talking about pudding. DeSantis has his dirty fingers all over senior entitlements. Tell Ron DeSantis to keep his pudding fingers off our money.
Here's the response from DeSantis World.
Donald Trump is being attacked by a Democrat prosecutor in New York. So why is he spending millions attacking the Republican governor of Florida? Trump's stealing pages from the Biden-Pelosi playbook, repeating lies about Social Security. Trump should fight Democrats, not lie about Governor DeSantis. What happened to Donald Trump?
The super PAC also ran this online-only ad about Trump that was targeted at Republicans who attended the NRA convention in Indianapolis over the weekend, where Trump spoke, but DeSantis did not.
Trump promised NRA members he'd have their back. But when Second Amendment rights came under attack, Trump abandoned us.
You guys, half of you are so afraid of the NRA.
I like taking the guns early. Take the guns first.
Trump cut and run like a coward. Trump, the gun grabber, doesn't deserve a second chance.
All right. What do you guys think of these ads? Take on the strategy behind them, and do you think they're effective, Tommy?
The pudding thing worked. It's weird and gross and funny and memorable, and it's getting covered in the mainstream media, on social media, and it's Trojan horsing in this message about cutting Social Security. It was well done.
It's a good point about the Trojan horsing.
I think the horse was pretty open.
No, but I get it because it's like, if you just did another Social Security Medicare hit,
no one's
going to
cover that? Right,
you get
pudding,
some fun pudding stuff in there.
We got some weird pudding pops.
Yeah, and then you got a really effective message about Social Security Medicare in there. A-plus ad.
It's an A-plus ad, and we were talking about this when it first came out. It's a shockingly normal political ad. It feels like it could be made by any normal, for a Democrat or a Republican. It's just a traditional, professional ad.
The first thing I thought was, I'm like, David Plouffe probably loves this ad.
I could see really
him.
Good.
This is like a Barack Obama versus John McCain ad, a Barack Obama versus Mitt Romney ad.
Like, and the DeSantis response, like when you whine about tactics, that to me always says you are losing. If you're saying, how dare Donald Trump attack a Republican? Are you just meeting Donald Trump? Did you not watch the primary? That's all he does. No Trump voters are upset that Trump is attacking another Republican. Also, first of all, I do think it gives you a little bit. There's a little bit of a hint of where they want to go, which is like, there's a little bit like he's creepy, he's filthy.
Oh, DeSantis.
There's a little bit of that, like, you know.
Yeah, he's a weirdo.
He's a weirdo, he's a creep. They want to get those photos with the teenagers back out there. So that's under there a little bit. The DeSantis response, I think, gives itself away when it ends with what happened to Donald Trump, which is kind of like saying, like, oh, because even the DeSantis ad says he used to be fucking awesome, you know?
Right.
Like, you don't want your own ad to say, like, God, I miss that Donald Trump guy.
Even the NRA ad, like, maybe there are some hardcore NRA fans and gun supporters that are upset by that ad, but most of the ad was Trump looking tough and talking about fighting the NRA, a powerful interest group. Like, are you kidding me?
It really was like, the gun one was much worse, I think, for DeSantis. First of all, the gun ad, who knows how it plays for the wackadoos attending an NRA convention, but it showed him negotiating for modest gun reforms with Democrats and Republicans. And we're 7 years into this fucking Trump fiasco, and you still think you get points by showing Trump not caring what interest groups think? Like, it's wild.
To me, it speaks, like, their theory of the case here is so flawed.
Yeah.
Like, Republican voters who are considering ditching Donald Trump are not doing so because they think he's not conservative enough on issues like guns or abortion, or because, like Tommy said, they think he's too mean to other Republicans. If they are considering ditching Donald Trump, it's because they are worried that he has now lost them several elections.
Right.
And for some insane reason, DeSantis isn't making an electability argument. But by the way, Trump is. Trump knows that's a vulnerability. And what he's trying to say is, hey, all you Republican voters who are maybe thinking about DeSantis, he's going to be a weak general election candidate because he wants to cut Medicare and Social Security, and because he's also a little weird.
Yeah,
a little establishment, a little too rhino, but like really vulnerable in a general election against Joe Biden. You sure you want to put Ron DeSantis up against Joe Biden? That's what Trump's trying to say. It's smart.
There's a lot of things I think you can get the Republican base to believe about Donald Trump, but you're never going to get them to believe he's not on their side. Like, first of all, everyone's tried that. It has never stuck.
No.
Aside from immigration, I would argue that Republican voters did not back Donald Trump in 2016 in the first place because of any specific policy position.
No.
Immigration was a big, it's vibes.
He's an asshole.
And it's also like, the guy doesn't sound like a regular fucking politician. And guess what? DeSantis does now.
And this is when DeSantis was doing well, when he was fighting Disney and yelling at, you know, woke corporations.
Which he's back at.
He's trying to do it again, yeah.
Yeah, and there's that that line from Mad Men that I'll paraphrase, which is, it's what I think of whenever I see DeSantis and Trump going at it, which is DeSantis is trying to make Republicans feel as if their needs are met, but Donald Trump makes them feel as if they have no needs. And it's just over and over again, DeSantis gets himself wrapped around the axle because he's trying to win on points, and there's this underlying kind of inherent qualities that these two guys have that he's not able to get past. Electability is the only thing.
Yeah, and you hear all these Trump people, that even the ones that they're interviewing now who are like thinking about both candidates, and they'll say, you know, what about Donald Trump? They're like, I wish he wouldn't tweet as much, and sometimes what he says gets in trouble, but I like that he says what's on his mind. I trust that. And with DeSantis, they don't trust that.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
Like, you want the fun dad that's going to take you on the roller coaster or not?
No one's going on any roller coasters now. Drive Disney World out of the state.
Go up the roller coaster, you can see the state prison he's putting in there.
Putting dead.
Yeah, he did make a joke that he was going to maybe put a prison in near Disney World just to punish them more. DeSantis is also trying to get to the right of Trump on the issue of abortion. He signed legislation late Thursday night that would ban abortion in the state of Florida after 6 weeks, which is essentially a full ban since most abortions occur after 6 weeks, and many people don't even know they're pregnant by 6 weeks. DeSantis didn't say a word about the new law at the multiple events he held around the country, which tells you how much of a winner he thinks the ban is.
Right.
One of DeSantis's billionaire donors, Thomas Petterfi, sounds like a perfect billionaire donor,
sure, yeah,
told the Financial Times that he and a bunch of his friends are now, quote, holding our powder dry because of the governor's stance on abortion and book banning. From a political standpoint, why do we think Ron DeSantis did this? He had a 15-week ban.
This seems like a political suicide. The numbers are not even close. The University of Florida did a poll in February that found that 75% of Florida residents opposed a 6-week ban, including 61% of Republicans. This is an insane idea. It will have huge ramifications outside of Florida because Florida was unfortunately a place a lot of women had to go to get abortion services because other states around it had even more draconian bans. The only reason the Florida legislature could pass this is because the state is so gerrymandered. But this just seems like an insane decision, like sort of a kamikaze political decision to try to win a primary that will have huge ramifications for DeSantis and the party in any general election.
Somebody close to DeSantis said this to the Washington Post. Abortion is not an issue that motivates him. I can tell you that. But it's one of those, what choice do we have? And it's like he clearly had hoped that the 15-week ban would get him to the other side of this issue without having to pick a fight with the evangelical base that wants a total ban. But he couldn't come out against this. He clearly didn't want to do a 6-week ban, but felt dragged to it by the right-wing members in the Florida legislature. And now he has tied himself to this evil fucking thing. And he can sign it behind closed doors all he wants. It is going to follow him for the rest of this campaign.
Clearly, like you guys said, the motivation is to try to win this primary and general election. We'll worry about that later. I don't even know if it really is going to help him in this primary, partly because of what we were just talking about with the NRA ad, too. It's like this theory that the evangelical base, they really just care about abortion and that's it. Like, maybe at one point they used to. It's all vibes now. They're not they're not backing Donald Trump, the guy who's probably paid for multiple abortions himself, who's been married multiple times because they think, you know, he's a righous person.
But also,
like, what are we doing here?
Take it from the other side. Donald Trump, on the issue of abortion, Donald Trump is the most successful Republican president in a half century. He stacked the court with right-wing judges who are anti-abortion. He delivered them the majority that got rid of Roe v. Wade. You can try to get to the right in this politically stupid way, but you're not going to win on that issue. It's really baffling.
There are reports that Trump's been telling anti-abortion activists that Republicans risk losing big on this issue unless they soften the messaging. And Trump wants to be emphasizing exceptions to bans. And he thinks that all of these total bans are bad now, which, by the way, for Trump is very silly because it's like you just said, he's the guy that literally his judges are the reason that Dobbs happened.
Well, he's basically saying, look, guys, we got to lie a little bit. Come on, work with me here.
He's been saying this for years. Yes. He's been saying this for years. Before he even got the majority to do it, he was worried about the political implications of this and kind of has always kind of joked about the evangelicals being kind of weird to him. He's never got them. They don't resonate on the same frequency.
No.
I mean, how long until Donald Trump starts openly attacking DeSantis for the 6-week ban?
You can see it.
It's going to be hypocritical, obviously, but he's going to be too extreme. He's not going to win the general Medicare and Social Security position, his abortion position. This guy's a weirdo. It's the pudding, the pedophilia.
The one piece of this is I can imagine DeSantis thinking like, I'm just trying to get past this issue, right? If he fights this thing that the majority of the caucus wants in the legislature, he's now in a fight over abortion that makes it more salient. He signed this law and now he kind of move past it, even though the politics will trail him. That's the only kind of cynical political argument you can say.
I think you can't move past it because he's going to own the ramifications. There's going to be story after story after story of the horrific consequences of this law.
I think it is crazy to me. I've really tried to think of it from his point of view, like just from pure hard politics.
I remember thinking he was smart for not doing this and just sort of standing behind the 15-week ban. That would be the more palatable politically, at least.
And there was the Republican Senate Majority Leader, who is someone who is less conservative on this issue, was asked why she was getting behind this. And she's like, ask Ron DeSantis. She basically was like, looking at him to help me get out of this fucking
thing. This is not like the legislature just like handed him something that he's like, oh, now I have to sign it or not sign it. Like, he runs that legislature. Right.
He had a choice to make whether he wanted to have the fight or not.
Yes.
Believe it or not, there are other Republicans in this race, though the potential field shrank by one over the weekend. As Never Give an Inch author Mike Pompeo did, in fact, give several inches when he announced that he won't be running for president, a political earthquake that upended the GOP primary. Other 2024 hopefuls seem to have a higher tolerance for embarrassment. Mike Pence was booed at the NRA convention in his home state where he once served as governor. Nikki Haley's campaign was caught lying about their fundraising totals. They inflated them by about $3 million because they were double counting a bunch of money. Like,
oops.
It's just getting through a news cycle, right? At a big GOP donor retreat in Nashville over the weekend, Governors Chris Sununu and Brian Kemp offered some gentle criticism of Trump. And then Trump got up there and mocked every single candidate's single-digit polling. He goes, it's actually pretty. He's like, Chris Christie, 1%. Wow, phenomenal. Nikki Haley, she's working hard. 4%, working hard. Now, before we get to the rest of the field, Tommy, is this Mike Pompeo announcement a huge blow to worldos everywhere?
Thank you, John, for asking. This was it was a tough weekend for me and tens of others. I prepared something.
He folded something up in his pocket.
I just wanted to.
Why would it be separate?
Andy and Olivia do have their hands over their mouths.
I don't understand why you'd have to print something. He has his laptop.
It's an important moment.
It's just drama.
We gather here today to mourn the death of Michael Richard Pompeo's presidential ambitions. I know that some of you traveled from as far away as Santa Monica to be here, and I just wanted to say thank you and that it means a lot to me. As Neil Young once wrote,
oh my God,
my, hey, hey, parens, out of the blue, close parens, it's better to burn out than it is to rust. The king is gone, but he's not forgotten. There's not a spot of rust on you, Mike.
Wow.
Once described in the New Yorker as a heat-seeking missile for Trump's ass, Mike Pompeo soared to intercontinental political heights. Born in Orange, California, to Dorothy and Wayne Pompeo, Mike met his real daddies, the Koch brothers, after moving to Kansas in the mid-90s. From there, he took on Congress, the deep state, the State Department, and the world. It's hard to quantify what his absence will mean, John. As John Steinbeck said, according to Brainy Quotes, it's so much darker when a light goes out than it would have been if it had never shone. Mike Pompeo, the Cav Pack, from tweets with no engagement to Tier 2 Sunday shows to sparsely attended Iowa events, you lit the way for dozens, and we will miss you.
Oh, it's a beautiful performance. He captured the tone. Okay. there it is again. We should also layer on the Ozempic jingle.
I thought, yeah, also...
just saying.
You think
he did that with discipline?
Wasn't he like the first person and maybe only person to blurb his own book too?
Oh yeah, he blurbed his own book. Yeah, he did his own book blurb. Yeah.
There was one part at the end. Thank you, Tommy, by the way.
Thank you for
giving me this moment.
The space.
So Mike Pompeo, whose whole public persona is about how sort of unstoppable he is, doesn't give an inch, decides to give all the inches and step out. And he releases a full-page statement on Twitter about why he's doing it. But the end of the statement to me captured everything that makes Mike Pompeo someone with just the absolute worst personality in public life. And he ended the statement by saying this: to those of you this announcement disappoints, my apologies. And to those of you this thrilled, know that I'm 59 years old. There remain many more opportunities for which the timing might be more fitting as presidential leadership becomes even more necessary.
What's the problem with that?
That is an incredible statement. Be it's very much like, I'm sorry, I can't meet you at the flagpole after school today. I have violin practice. But next couple of days, we're going to find a time. And boy, are we going to fight at that flagpole.
He is
really embarrassing.
Don't threaten us with a good time, Mikey.
It's like, but also even the end of that statement, so you're saying that now is not the time for presidential leadership, but in the future it might be. It's just so arrogant and stupid. God,
yeah.
May his memory be a blessing.
Yeah,
I miss him already.
Raises a question. We're not going to do predictions here.
Yeah.
We're not going to. That's going to feel like a little 20. Oh, you know. Do you so far? Do you think any of these fucking yahoos are showing what it takes? Not even to beat Trump, but to be the new Ron DeSantis, if for some reason Ron DeSantis continues to shit the bet.
It's pretty, you would say all right, obviously none of these other fucking jokers, but you look at someone like Tim Scott and you say, okay, maybe, and then he gets the most obvious question
fumbles
that you could possibly be asked about abortion and gives an absolute, just a word salad in response. Though it actually captures, I think, the problem that has nothing to do with each one of those individuals. There was a sort of a column looking at the politics of what Tim Scott is supposed to say. And he's supposed to find a place in the Venn diagram that will please the evangelical base without pissing off the vast majority of Americans who are pro-choice. And they don't overlap. They just don't overlap.
No, nor does the Republican base and being hopeful.
Yeah.
That's not what they're looking for.
It seems like the plan right now is once again to hope that Donald Trump will implode on his own, even though they all chose to defend him over the indictment that might have led to that implosion.
Yeah.
So even when things come up that might hurt Donald Trump, no one is going to take advantage of it or hasn't so far. No one wants to exploit it. If you do not go after Donald Trump directly and do so, and again, I get that most of the base and most of the voters you need loves Donald Trump, so you have to be careful in how you do it. But the electability argument is what's on Republican voters' minds. They are willing to hear a case about that. Just fucking go do it.
It's a bunch of people throwing buckets of water on a house fire, hoping that the house burns down. How about that?
Okay. I like that. I like that.
Just came to me.
Let's talk about Congress, which is back in session this week.
They're back, baby.
Didn't even know they were gone.
I didn't know, yeah.
Kevin McCarthy is still trying to pass a budget through the Republican House that raises the debt ceiling. His latest plan is a one-year extension of the debt ceiling to May of 2024, right in the middle of campaign. That should be fun.
Good idea.
And this plan would gut all non-defense, non-entitlement spending, repeal student loan forgiveness, repeal clean energy tax credits that were in the IRA, increase fossil fuel production, and institute work requirements for Medicaid and food assistance. What's the thinking behind this plan? What are the chances it actually passes? Love it.
It's funny to say what's the thinking behind the plan. It's Kevin McCarthy. He is the political equivalent of checking your watch while holding a coffee. And you know, as a rule, when Kevin McCarthy does something, you could ask, if you don't really understand it, it's like, is he smart or is he stuck? And the answer is never that he's smart. And in this case, you would want to say, okay, he knows he's in a bind. He made all these promises to the base to get the speakership. So he needs to go through the motions of putting forward these kind of draconian cuts to show that this can't pass, ultimately on the road to what can pass, which is a clean increase that is mostly passed with Democrats in the House with some Republicans who jump on board. You would like to think that that is what we're heading towards, but more likely he is just putting one foot in front of the other, trying to get through a day. Beyond that, I don't know.
He's just trying to figure out, he has to put something forward so he can blame Biden for refusing to negotiate, and they haven't released a budget yet, I think, still, even after the speech. The thing that bumped me was doing this speech at the stock market was an interesting choice.
Yeah, he went to Wall Street today and spoke at the stock market.
Yeah, a bit like an Al-Qaeda member doing a press conference on an airplane, you know what I mean? Like, check out this thing I'm about to crash. I don't know.
Oh, I see.
I guarantee you that these CEOs care a hell of a lot more about their stock price than deficit spending.
Look, I don't know what the guy's doing. I mean, it's what you said, Tommy. He wants to, all he's thinking about is, I got to get something through the House, right? And so I got to find a majority of House, I've got to find basically all of his House Republicans to vote for this plan. And that means he needs the Freedom Caucus wackos. He needs the problem solvers, right? He needs everyone. He needs most of the caucus. And then if he can pass it, he can say, okay, Joe Biden, you told me you'd sit down and negotiate if I had a plan. I passed a plan. If you don't like it, that's fine, but at least sit down and negotiate. So then he gets Biden to the negotiating table. The question is, can he even get this passed the House? Because the way this plan is now, it's not the draconian balanced budget in 10 years, which they've all given up on, or cutting Medicare and Social Security, which they seem to have given up on as well. But the cuts are deep enough that some moderate Republicans are already starting to balk at the plan.
Yeah, it all is heading to the same place, whether it gets killed by some House Republicans or it makes it to the Senate and gets killed by Republicans there. We're heading to a place where at some point this will be, the question will become, will Kevin McCarthy say, sorry, guys, I tried? And that is where this has to head, but it doesn't seem like he's going to acknowledge that anytime soon.
I just think he's trying to keep the speakership as long as he possibly can. But I mean, creating work requirements to receive Medicaid and food stamps. So if you have cancer, you have to go out and get a job, and then you can get chemotherapy. That's what we're doing here. And then Reuters found that most of the spending cuts McCarthy wants will hurt states Trump won in 2020 more than blue states.
No, yeah, both the cuts to domestic spending on education and transportation would hurt those states, and instituting work requirements would also hurt those states because the vast majority of people who are on Medicaid and food assistance are in those states.
Yeah, you sort of step back from all this. It's like, no, these ridiculous cuts are never going to become law. There's probably not 40 votes in the Senate for
something. Yeah, they're dead.
And so, okay, well, where are we heading? And it's just, whatever shenanigans McCarthy pulls over the next few months, is he going to bring to the floor something that would pass with majority Democratic votes? And
then lose the speakership, yeah.
And then lose the speakership.
But I do think if it if this fails in the House, this plan, if he can't even get it through the House, ironically, we might get a better outcome sooner.
Yeah.
Because he will continue to fucking drag this along if he gets it through the House, he's going to claim it's a big win. We're going to know it's not. The press is probably going to be, oh, McCarthy got it passed. We're going to get a round of time for Joe to negotiate.
Or it's like, now it falls to McConnell. And there's just going to be, yes, sure.
It is going to be a bring McCarthy. Why don't you bring McCarthy to the White House and just sit down and talk about the plan? You don't have to accept the plan. You just have to negotiate. And Biden's going to have to say, no, I don't want to negotiate. It's got to be a clean debt ceiling.
And this is what McCarthy is telling to the members that are like, don't make me vote for this fucking
that's
thing.
Right. That's just right. But if McCarthy fails now, then I think it's right to... Then McConnell and Schumer have to get together and figuring something out that
they
jam through the House.
But someone has to call it for a vote on the floor.
Yeah. We have an update on 89-year-old Dianne Feinstein, who Lovett's been trying to shove out of the Senate.
Mm. Excuse me. There's no shoving.
Gentle.
An invitation.
A push.
An invitation. Thing? An invitation.
Just sort of a...
Prodding. Cattle.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Schumer said he spoke to the senator, who said she hopes to return soon, but he still wants to appoint a temporary replacement on the Judiciary Committee. Ain't happening. first they thought maybe unanimous consent. Then Tom Cotton was like, nope, not unanimous consent. And then they're like, okay, well, you could do it with 60 votes if maybe Mitch McConnell will help us out.
Yeah.
And then all these Republican senators over the course of the day are like, what? Why would we help Democrats confirm judges?
Absolutely not.
Which, of course, if the shoe was on the other foot and this was a old Republican senator that they were trying to replace, would we be like, oh, yeah, Democratic senator,
months.
Help out Mitch McConnell. Help them pass those
judges.
Of course
not. Of course not.
Crazy?
So there was the idea that there would be these 10 Republican votes, like everyone from the furthest right, like Hodden, all the way to like Susan Collins are like, I'm sorry, what are you asking me? Absolutely not.
Never.
No.
So what other options are there now? Love it.
There's really two options. Option number one is that Senator Feinstein returns to the Senate to participate in her vital work as a representative of the most populous state and a member of the Judiciary Committee, or she resigns.
And although you and I were talking about this before the pod, if she resigns, it still might be hard to replace her.
It still might be hard to replace
her
on the committee. Yeah. So basically, there's been a lot of kind of, I think, now this will happen on Twitter. I don't know if you noticed it. People just saying things like Schumer can replace her. No. In fact, Schumer does not have the ability to put anyone on a committee. That requires the Senate to vote. Now, normally that happens without incident at the beginning of the Senate. It's very, it's very decorous. Everybody gets along. But it requires 60 votes or unanimous consent, which is ultimately the same thing. And that have basically Republicans get together, decide who's on their committees, Democrats get together, and then they all kind of agree. Although, if you remember, there was a moment at the beginning of the last Senate where Mitch McConnell held up the vote with a filibuster for a while. I remember we were like, the committees can't meet. It's going to be really important. We've all forgotten about it, but it did happen. Mm-hmm. But Cornyn today told reporters that the temporary replacement thing is out of the question, but there's a precedent for a senator resigning and there being an opening in the normal course of business that they would allow someone to fill the seat. Now, my concern...
But they could be assholes if they wanted.
Well, my concern is that we've now had like a two-week news cycle that began with Dick Durbin saying, hey, I can't confirm judges, that is now... basically made this not about a routine filling of an opening, but a question of will Democrats get to confirm more judges? So I worry that that has planted a seed that is growing in the minds of the fertile minds of your Tom's Cotton and so forth.
If only you hadn't started this news cycle.
Dick Durbin started this news cycle. I just helped it along.
Don't blame Durbin. You always blame Durbin for everything.
I don't know what to do with this power, guys. I've never felt so power. I'm eating raw meat and thinking about what other old people I can push out of their jobs.
How about Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's a good idea.
Perfect segue, Tommy.
That's
perfect
a good idea.
Segue.
Oh, wait. I just want to make one more point, though, about
we were so close. We
amazing
were flying
segue.
Into the next.
What else you got?
What else you got? How powerful are you?
Yeah, just rank this fucking.
I just want to make one more point about this, all right? Which is because this could happen quickly between pods, and I just need to have said this. Which is this.
You don't want Dan to take this point?
Yeah. Which is this.
That's how it usually goes.
given
you gotta say it before it ends up in the message box.
His lips to God's ears, right?
It usually goes the other way. It usually goes message box through me to the pot, I'm basically ChatGPT for add jokes to message box. but basically, if Senator Feinstein can't return soon and she does decide to, as the LA Times said, heroically step aside, which I think is a nice term.
I like that too.
Then it would be Newsom's job to fill the seat. Newsom promised to Joy Reid in March of 2021 that he would replace Dianne Feinstein with a black woman. Barbara Lee is obviously a black woman who is running for the seat. That would mean that if he were to appoint Barbara Lee, that would mean both Senate seats were filled by appointment. And now I don't think, given that the campaign's already started, I don't think that means we don't have a race between Adam Schiff and Katie Porter and Barbara Lee. But I do think... everyone who's paying attention to this, I think we all should really hope that Gavin Newsom appoints. He said when he told Joy Reid, there are many people on his list. He should appoint someone if this seat opens up that is not going to run for the seat, so that Democrats so that we have a chance to vote for a senator, so that both of our senators have not come from an appointment, but that one of our senators has been chosen by us in an election.
Look, I just want to thank you very much for making that point that we discussed extensively on Thursday's pod.
Yeah, but I didn't discuss it. And that now
just
when is
a
that?
Whole how conversation.
Did you
exactly that?
Did they really?
Leave it in. It's all
wait,
staying.
Wait, how much Andy, how much
leave
of it?
It
how much
in.
Of it?
The leave sausage has
wait,
been
did, what do you mean? Wait, Andy. 75%. So you just cut it then?
No, we're leaving
it
in.
No, now we're leaving it in.
I got to listen to the Thursday pod?
Yeah.
I'm making a show Thursday. Check it for me. Let's see if we can tighten this up.
We'll get you a reader.
Clarence Thomas. The right-wing justice now plans to amend his financial disclosure forms after ProPublica, on a roll, reported that he failed to include a real estate deal with sugar daddy Harlan Crowe, where the Nazi memorabilia buff bought three properties from Thomas, including a home where the justice's mother still lives rent-free. The Washington Post then reported that Thomas has also erroneously claimed income from a defunct real estate firm for the last several years, though that one may be more of a bookkeeping error, but, you know, not great. So Dick Durbin, who's just coming up all the time these days, people are talking more and more about him these days. Yeah, he's being recognized more and more. He said that they'll hold a hearing about Supreme Court ethics on the Judiciary Committee, but some activists are calling on Congress to subpoena Thomas to testify. Can they? Should they? What do we think? Tommy?
I mean, they should give it a shot. I do want to just talk about this real estate deal for a minute, because Harlan Crowe, they buy the house that Clarence Thomas's mother still lives in. Someone did the math on how much rent she hasn't paid, and they say Business Insider suggests that saved her $150,000. So that's interesting. He also bought like the whole neighborhood. He's gentrifying the whole neighborhood, and he's refurbishing this house that Clarence Thomas's mother lives in while also saying he wants to turn it into a museum. Which is
I missed the museum part.
Oh, yeah. No, it's all about a museum.
Which is a weird thing.
For more Nazi memorabilia?
No. For Clarence Thomas.
Yeah, like a Clarence Thomas museum. But if you're going to turn, if they're going to be like, this is his childhood home.
I run out of places to keep all my Nazi memorabilia.
if you're going to like turn a childhood home into a museum, you probably don't like gut the place and refurbish it, right? So it's also not the first time he's made some sort of bookkeeping error. Thomas failed to disclose his wife's income from the Heritage Foundation for years. Oh. She made $686,000 between 2003 to 2007. And he kept clicking like the box that said no on whether she had any non-investment income.
You know,
it's just mistakes keep happening to him.
He doesn't think these are rules matter or that they're important or that he should be held to any kind of standard. To your question, John, can they subpoena him and should they? They can and they should.
Yeah,
that's it. They can and they should. And there's gonna be a lot.
If Dianne Feinstein comes back.
We're going to need every vote. We're going to need every vote. And Sheldon. And I don't want to be a shingles issue voter, but I do think it's really important.
Oh, my God. Can't believe you saved that till now.
I forgot. I typed it, actually. I forgot to say it earlier. That's prepped, just in case. If I'm canceled for it, just know that it was premeditated.
That's good. Sheldon Whitehouse is pushing the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, to investigate Thomas as well.
Yeah, I think.
Oh yeah, we'll be dead by then.
Yeah, Merrick Garland wandering in the Justice Department with his candle and his nightgown, slowly moving through the old house. But look, there's been a lot of senators saying how there's so many different people that should be doing oversight. Well, they should do it too. They should give it a shot.
Yeah, look, I realize there's not going to be an extremely satisfying outcome to this, likely. But just from a pure political perspective, like. What's going to happen? There's all this corruption surrounding this judge. He doesn't have a high approval ratings, nor does the institution in which he serves at this point. You drag him before the Senate to ask him a bunch of questions. Yeah, it's a bad news cycle for 2 days and maybe doesn't go. But what's the harm?
Even Mitt Romney today was asked about this. And he said that this story stinks.
They're going to retaliate.
He did.
So it's like, then you were, oh, what, now they're going to call justices all the time to testify. Great.
Okay. Great.
Drag Elena Kagan before the Republican Senate Judiciary Committee someday. Sonia Sotomayor, what are they going to do? They're going to give great answers.
Yeah, remember when they were like, we're going to get Hillary Clinton to testify all day about Benghazi? She made you look like dopes. It was the best day of the campaign
for her.
Right,
yeah. That's not retribution that I'm really worried about.
Okay, counterpoint.
She did say.
This is from the Wall Street Journal opinion piece defending Clarence Thomas.
Oh.
Quote, one may be tempted to think that of all people, a judge should know what the law says, but that's a nonsensical standard. A judge's job isn't to memorize statute books, it's to discern law's meaning and their application to the facts and cases that litigants bring before him.
How are we not doing Take Appreciator today? That's a full playbook.
I stole
it's that is a there. Full playbook.
James Toronto?
It's
Oh, he's awful.
I think I muted or blocked him.
You know, when we were in Wisconsin for the Supreme Court race, it was this incredibly like refreshing thing that everybody was just campaigning not on some imaginary concept of what a judge does with calls, balls, and strikes. I'm going to be the most impartial person you've ever seen. But it was like, hey, this is an ideological context.
Yeah.
There are real stakes. We have real views. Abortion is on the line. Democracy on the line. We should just be doing everything we can to like pull the Supreme Court like down from this mountaintop it's been on. They are
They're doing a pretty good job themselves.
Yeah, they are.
Haven't
but like
too much.
They're lawyers in drag. six of them are freaks. At least one's a criminal. Let's do everything we can to have accountability. Just like it's the right thing to do.
When is John Roberts doing another public event? Because someone needs to say to him, "Hey, man, you whine all the time about political attacks and the legitimacy of the court and don't attack it, blah, blah, blah. You are doing more harm to the court's reputation than anyone else by letting this flagrant corruption go and not saying a word, anything.
I bet his schedule is pretty clear right now.
And what's he up to?
I bet he's not, well, I don't think he wants to appear at a public event and get that question.
Dorks are always talking at some law school about something.
This is the problem, is they're so insulated from any kind of, this is why if you can subpoena him, it's a good thing to subpoena him.
There's going
to
be a whole, idiotic news cycle. People throw in terms like separation of powers and overreach, and it's already being described as a showdown.
Just asking fucking you to come answer some questions.
But the idea that like, the idea that the laws that Thomas is accused of breaking are made by Congress. If he is to be impeached, it's going to be impeached by Congress. He has got that seat because he was confirmed by the Senate. It's not a violation of the separation of powers to have a Supreme Court justice testify for Congress.
Look, we're building support, in my mind at least, for term limits. That's what I want. Yeah. Expanding the court, that's a little bit of a fantasy right now. That's like the thinking we're going to get rid of the Electoral College.
Yeah,
it's far, far, far away.
You're probably not on that PJ after 6 years. That's like a 12-year kind of.
Well,
like,
he famously said he's been on the court for 30. He's like, I've been friends with Harlan Crowe for 25 years.
Let's start by trying to get some term limits on the Supreme Court. That's my new thought.
Let's see if we can get.
We're all going to yell about expanding the court, and we're so far from that. We're so far from being able to do that and having the votes. But I bet. Term limits is probably easier, and I still think it would be pretty effective.
Yeah, I think a lot of these octogenarian senators are going to be big fans of term limits.
What else you guys talk about on Thursday?
a lot of senators just looking at that wet bathroom floor thinking, there but for the grace of God go I.
All right, when we come back, Tommy and I will talk to...
Do not DMCA this. It's just YouTube.
When we come back, Tommy and I will talk to Crooked contributor Max Fisher about the Fox versus Dominion trial. The defamation case between Fox News and Dominion voting systems is scheduled to kick off this week, though as of right now, we're recording this on Monday afternoon, a last-minute settlement is still possible, guys.
Could be in the offing.
Could be in the offing. Here to talk about the strength of Dominion's lawsuit and the many implications of this case is Crooked's newest contributor, Max Fisher. Hey, Max.
Hey, pals.
What's going on?
Thanks for having me.
Why aren't you in Wilmington? That's where all the cool kids are.
I'm hologramming in from Wilmington.
Oh, right. That's what that is.
All the media reporters.
It is wild down here. It is popping off.
Some very fired up media
hanging
reporters.
Hanging out in Delaware.
In Wilmington for no trial.
The case of the century.
It's a glamorous field. What can I say?
There's been reporting that Fox has wanted to settle this case for a while now, but so far Dominion has refused. What do you think might get them to change their minds at this late stage?
So we don't know why Dominion has declined to settle. It stands to reason that Fox News wants to because they've already settled one separate case over 2020 election lies. There are two kind of most plausible reasons in my mind, although we don't know for sure. One is just that Dominion and Fox News might just have very different reads on the likelihood of the suit succeeding, because successful lawsuits, defamation lawsuits against big media companies are really rare because the standard is so high for them, which I know we're going to talk about. So it might just be like there's not a lot of precedent to look through to see the likely outcomes. Another that I find a little bit more persuasive, but it's speculative, is that Dominion has a bunch of defamation cases out right now related to this specific set of lies around the 2020 election. And this might partly be about signaling resolve to those other defendants that we are really willing to go to trial, like watch us. So therefore, we're not going to be pushovers when it comes to settlement.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I've been reading about this, and what struck me is that Dominion seems to have a pretty strong case on the liability front, on the fact that Fox is liable for this, but less of a strong case on the amount of damages that they asked for, which is $1.6 billion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think the company was valued at like $80 million.
Right. Yeah, some of these numbers are a little like pulled from thin air.
So perhaps if this is less about a cause for Dominion and more about like just it's a company and it wants financial rewards here from Fox, they just want to settle and get as much money as they can.
Yeah.
Though for all of us, we'd rather we'd rather go to trial.
We like the show.
We like the show. Or like a very public apology from Fox.
Right. It's the whole thing is a little weird because, like, the reason that we care about it and that, like, people should care about it is that it is a test for, like, how far can you go in lying about elections and inciting insurrection? But the terms that the case will be decided on are, like you're saying, it's like, how do you count up corporate damages?
Yeah.
So there's this, like, I think, like, something that is coming through a lot of this is there's a little bit of a mismatch between the significance of the trial and the actual, like, facts of it on the face. I mean, it's also possible, like, you know, they make voting systems. Maybe they care about the sanctity of democracy.
What?
I know. These are lawyers we're talking about. So it's possible I'm overly optimistic there.
Well, so, Max, I mean, you sort of alluded to this. I mean, you're seeing a lot of coverage of this case where it's described as like the trial of the century for press freedom. The First Amendment seems important in, as far as amendments go. Is that fair? would you agree?
I'd rank it number one.
Freedom of speech, freedom of the press are sort of derived from this. So, but when it comes to libel law, I know a lot of liberals, us included, are rooting against Fox because they lied and they did it egregiously and that is bad and we want them punished here. But the landmark case that protects all of us from liability was brought by a racist Alabama guy who oversaw the police during the civil rights era against the New York Times and a bunch of civil rights leaders. So it can cut both ways. So, you know, for you as a lifelong journalist, how do you feel about the prospect of a potential new precedent that could govern, you know, or curtail press freedom?
Right. So the premise of that is, of course, that the standard set in that 1964 Supreme Court trial is famously incredibly high for proving defamation against a media organization. It's always really set the United States apart and is considered part of its press freedoms that it is so, so hard to prove defamation by a media organization because you have to prove that they internally in their own minds knew they were lying when they did it, which is incredibly hard to prove.
The actual malice standard.
The actual malice standard. Yeah, exactly. And so because of that, there are very, very few successful defamation suits against the media, even when they get it wrong. And that's seen as an important part of the protections for, like, you can get something wrong and it's not going to blow up your entire news agency. I think that there is a view among a lot of First Amendment lawyers and maybe a lot of journalists that that standard is a little bit out of sync with how much our world has changed in the last 65 years and even just the last 5 or 10 years where extreme polarization is so high now and the media environment is so kind of wild west because of social media, because you get all these little networks like Newsmax, One American News popping up, and the stakes of it are so high because we've seen that it can lead to insurrection and coups that maybe there is a need to effectively soften those standards a little bit. Now, the people bringing these cases aren't saying we want to overturn that standard. They're all saying we meet that standard set in 1964. But any First Amendment lawyer will tell you if a good number of these cases, because Dominion is bringing a bunch, Smartmatic, another voting machine company is bringing a bunch, if a good number of these cases succeed because it's set by a Supreme Court precedent, not by law, it will move that standard a little bit in practice. And maybe that is necessary in an age where our democracy is at imminent risk from disinformation. And I think there's also a case for it on journalism grounds that, like, if you are concerned about the future of journalism in this country and faith in journalism as an institution, maybe you want some harder guardrails to come up in the form of higher threats of liability because, you know, I don't like the fact that people think of the media as a monolith and think of journalism as a monolith, but they do. And their perception of whether journalism as a concept works and can be trusted is tied up in how they perceive some of the largest actors in the media. So you maybe want, if you care about journalism, people to see their consequences for deliberately lying. But at the same time, I do have this reservation that cuts a little bit the other way where there is this specific scenario that I wouldn't say keeps me up at night, but I do worry about in a world where a good number of these cases succeed and that standard for bringing a defamation suit gets a little fuzzier, which is that it would become, I think, a little bit easier for companies with big pockets to try to bully or coerce news agencies into not running or into watering down stories that they don't want to see run, even if everybody knows the story is true. Because this thing that big companies will do, and they've done it to me many times, is when you go to them with a story that they don't like, they will try to extract as much information from you as they possibly can about what's going to be in the story. And journalistically, you're compelled to like at least take that seriously because you're supposed to give them an opportunity to comment, to respond to things. Right. They will go to your editors and try to get as much information as they can about the story. They'll go to your boss's bosses and try to get information. And then they will create a paper trail of giving you lots of emails and things in writing saying that thing that you're going to report, that is not true. That's false. And the thing you learn very quickly is
so
that...
then they trap you into deliberately...
Exactly.
Lying,
right.
Which
right.
Is
right.
Actual malice, which would be the actual malice.
Exactly.
And in London, this is a big problem, right? You've Russian oligarchs bringing completely frivolous lawsuits against journalists and basically, you know, putting them out of business with fees for attorneys, et cetera.
Right. Right. And the fear is if you're the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a big company is creating this paper trail and saying, you know, all of these things you're going to report are not true, even if you know they're lying, if you make some innocent mistake along
scary.
The way, right, then they can hold the threat over you of are they going to bankrupt your news agency right. over this one mistake.
There's been a lot of talk about this very high standard of actual malice, which is, you know, either the outlet knows the information they aired was false or did so with, quote, reckless disregard for the truth. That's the description of the standard.
Right.
But in this case, it does seem like Dominion might be able to meet that very high standard. Like, we might not even need to move the standard at all, just because, and you see a lot of First Amendment lawyers, a lot of media lawyers who've like represented media companies in these cases before, just saying that, like, I mean, the sheer amount of texts, emails, testimony that we've already seen in the pretrial period suggests that, yeah, Fox did deliberately know they were wrong. Like, you don't even have to go with the reckless disregard for the truth standard, which is the easier right. one. They clearly knew this. What do we know at this stage about the strengths and weaknesses of Dominion's case?
So there's not a, like, email from Rupert Murdoch saying, we're going to do the big lie now and lie about Dominion voting systems. But it's pretty close. It's
yeah.
pretty close. You have to do, like, a little bit of connecting the dots. It's not like a 1,000,000% slam dunk.
Yeah.
But basically what you have is, after the election, you have a bunch of internal emails and text messages within Fox News, which we have now because they came out in discovery in the course of this lawsuit, saying, we know that this Dominion conspiracy theory that's out there and Trump's election denial generally is false. Because initially they said, we don't want to follow him on it. They said, we don't want to go there. And they were talking about how the, like, Sidney Powell, who's Trump's lawyer, was pushing the Dominion conspiracy about how she's crazy and she doesn't have any evidence. And then you see that their ratings start to drop. And then they start making, it's not exactly they say, let's do this Dominion conspiracy after all to get viewers back, but you see them kind of allow themselves to be pulled in to making this choice because they have a couple anchors who are a little bit rogue and errant, and at first they're concerned about that, and then they're saying, well, actually, this has a lot of ratings. And then they're saying, well, actually, we need to bring our viewers back. And so I think that it's clearly pretty strong, which is why it's going to trial in the first place. Whether they can prove, you know, each step along the way adds up to an intentional lie that is responsible for that level of damages is going to turn a lot on not just were they lying, because of course they were, and the judges basically come out and said, I think that they're lying, but whether they can prove that the executives at the company were involved in the lie.
Well, and that's key because I've seen that now they want to go with the defense that Lou Dobbs and Maria Bartiromo actually believed this.
Yeah,
and so it wasn't deliberately spreading misinformation. So they really believe this and they're just crazy. So we're going to throw them under the bus. But I think the judge said at one point in the pretrial period, like, it's not about who said it. It's about the choice to publish and air these lies. And
right.
that rests with the executives.
Right. Or it rests, or at least it doesn't. They can't push it off on the guests because initially they were saying, we're just reporting what the president and his allies are saying. These are just guests on our show. We're not responsible for the lies they tell. And I think what Judge Davies was saying is that, no, you chose to air that and you knew it was a lie when you chose to air it. So that is not that you're responsible for that. The question is whether Fox will be able to, as you say, to portray Lou Dobbs and Maria Bartiromo as rogue actors. And we know now that they actually tried to coerce one of the assistants on Maria Bartiromo's show into giving false testimony that would portray Bartiromo.
Seems bad.
Right, yeah. It seems bad, and it also seems bad for Fox's case
yeah.
that assistant then came out and sued the network. And it does seem like she was also pretty complicit in that lie coming out. So she's not the most sympathetic figure.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of documentation that the executives were at the very least aware that it was happening and aware that it was false and chose not to intervene or pushed it to happen.
Yeah. I want to push you on this sort of question of democracy, play a little devil's advocate here, because you do hear a lot of people say, like, well, with the big lie, this is bigger. This is about a threat to our democracy, right? But I think a lot of academics in particular would argue that press freedom is core to democracy right now. In India, for example, ostensibly the world's largest democracy, the leader of the biggest opposition party, the Congress Party, was just sentenced to 2 years in prison for defamation of Prime Minister Modi. Actually, of like three dudes named Modi for reasons I'll set aside. That seems to be the biggest threat to India's democracy, using defamation law to throw an opposition leader in jail. What do you make of the argument that this case could do more harm than good to our democracy if it in any way curtails press freedom?
I think we are balancing through these trials, although no one in the trial is doing this deliberately. We are balancing a really tough set of questions about our democracy, about how we balance the absolute standards of press freedom that we have right now against the rising threat of deliberate disinformation that clearly subsumed Fox News, even against the wills of its own hosts and executives, that they felt compelled to tell these lies that they knew were going to these extremes. How do you balance those things? How do you balance the freedom to get things wrong in the media against the clearly rising intentionality of lies? And just the fact that we are in such a rapidly changing political environment where we have so many political actors now who are leading the media rather than the other way around and trying to pull them towards election denialism that has clearly real gravity and real weight with the audience. I mean, it's an irony that these big weighty questions of trade-offs are being litigated through a question of corporate damages for a profit company, which, like, welcome to the United States of America. Yeah, like, that's where the priorities are. Yeah. It's not like if you tell lies that lead to an insurrection, like, we're not going to sue you over that. But, you know, you lose some profits for a company. That's bad.
It's also like, what do you define as journalism? You know, we've talked about Fox a lot on this program, and they like to think of themselves as a media outlet. I think there was a time when other journalists would think of them as a media outlet that was just conservative. I think that time has passed for a lot of people who aren't Fox fans or MAG people. So then, like, are you able to get away with just lying intentionally because you call yourself a media outlet?
Right.
You know, and I think that's one of the things to balance as well.
Yeah. And it's degrees to it. I think what's fascinating about the disclosures that we saw of Fox News's internal emails and text messages is you actually see them wrestling with this question in real time, because they have reporters. They do have, they're obviously a diminishing part of the network, but they do have reporters who do reporting. And they had a reporter who fact-checked, I think, one of Sidney Powell's press conferences and was getting just dragged internally within the network because people saw, the host saw, the executive saw that was playing into hurting their ratings. Now, at the same time, the executive,
I think Hannity and maybe Tucker Carlson said, we need to fire her, like, right away. Was
right,
the
right. They right, claimed that she was hurting the stock price, which I might actually be true.
Right.
Oh, yeah, sure was.
Hopefully.
And, you know, you saw Rupert Murdoch initially after the election saying, we're not going to go down election misinformation. We're not going to go around down election denial because I think this is bad for the country. And then he changed his mind. So I don't have any delusions that the people at Fox are going to make the right choice because of ethical reasons. But I think there is a question of what are the financial incentives that are going to push them to do the right thing. And maybe ultimately the question of what right-wing media in this country looks like will come down to, are the financial penalties of lying to the extent that Fox and others lied going to exceed the financial penalties of telling the truth, which means that you're going to lose viewers to
lose market share.
YouTube channels, basically. I mean,
what do you think it says about Fox and the larger right-wing media ecosystem that they felt the need to chase these online conspiracies because they were afraid of losing viewers?
So it's so fascinating because it didn't look like what I thought it was going to look like. You know, I really thought that watching, like, Fox News arrive at this place in real time in 2020, that it was, you know, they love Trump, they want to keep Republicans in power, so they're making a deliberate top-down choice to broadcast these conspiracies. And what we know now is that they did it basically out of fear, and they did it out of this realization that they had. I mean, you can pinpoint it almost exactly to like November 12th, if you look, or like November 10th, 12th, if you look at the emails and the text messages, where they initially said, we're not going to do election denial. And they thought that that decision was going to be enough to shape the narrative, because for 25 years, Fox News has been in charge of what the right thinks. And they've had an iron grip on what are the narratives, what are the facts, you know, who's right, who's wrong, what are the good policies, bad policies. And you see them realize that that's not true anymore. And they no longer have the power to set that narrative, because they can tell people that Trump lost the election and then they're just going to go someplace else. And that they are realizing that they now live in a world where there is always going to be someone, some social media, some crazy network, Trump himself, who will serve the kind of most base extreme QAnon parts of the party. And they made the wrong choice in deciding what to do about that. But I think it's a big question about what choice are they going to make going forward. And I mean, hopefully facing at least the threat of financial penalties will guide them on a better direction.
Well, and to Tommy's questions about sort of the balance between protecting press freedom and stopping the spread of disinformation, the fact that Fox now chases these conspiracies that are mainly developed online that then get fed to places like OAN and Newsmax makes that question even more complicated, because, again, what is a media outlet if it starts in some 4chan forum and it spreads around and YouTube? And it's like,
I would argue, though, they've been doing that for a long time. I mean, what was the birther conspiracy if not for like an online thing that hopped to Fox and to other, you know, so look, I mean, I think like this is, the courts are catching up with Fox's practice for a while here.
I think the internet was always a, or at least for the last 20 years, however long we've been doing this, I think the internet was always a source,
right?
But the power, their power to set the narrative and change it and cut it off, that has diminished.
Oh, absolutely.
It feels like it's flipped almost.
I mean, like, you know, I think the big moment was when they sent Megyn Kelly out to ask Trump a bunch of tough questions at a debate. He attacked her in the most vile ways imaginable. They backed her for a couple days and then eventually showed her the door.
You know what's funny is when you just said Megyn Kelly, I thought you were going to talk about the 2012 election night. Remember when Karl Rove,
Karl Rove
and,
like
and all
the
Romney people were like,
that was incredible.
No, Obama didn't win yet. This is fine, whatever. And they were, because they forgot that that black people voted in Milwaukee. And then Megyn Kelly went over and was like, no, that's wrong. He, you know, and so like that was the reverse. And Fox was able to.
Right. They did have that power.
Stop the crazies. But they've long lost that power.
Right. I think you're right, though, that the 2016 election was like another big version of this moment, or it's what you see with the Republican establishment. Like 2016, they hated Trump, tried to stop him, failed, and then we're like, I guess we'll just embrace him no matter where it takes us.
Yeah, get in front of this parade.
Yeah,
train. No,
it is
train
clear.
Call it a parade. Yeah,
it is clear that there are not a lot of tools to fight disinformation right now, and the legal one that we're going to be witnessing this week and in the coming weeks is definitely a different one that we've talked about over the last several years, and it's not perfect. The standard's not perfect, but we'll see what happens.
It does feel like it in my mind, it's very of a piece with the Trump Stormy Daniels indictment and the many other indictments, where it's like it's a sideways way into what I think is like the biggest question facing this country right now, which is there going to be accountability for trying to do a coup and overturn American democracy 2 years ago?
Because the guy who did it is, you know, a coin flip away from becoming president again.
Crazy. Yeah. Although maybe president from a jail cell.
That's either way. Max Fisher, thanks for joining us in this. And I know you're going to be following the trial for these next couple weeks, if there is a trial.
Yeah.
Unless we wake up and there's a settlement.
Big settlement.
Are you guys
tomorrow
coming down to Wilmington with me?
Yes, we'll be there.
Okay. Yeah, Joe says it's fun. There's things to do. Maybe we can go crash at his house. I don't know.
Does Amtrak go there from L.A.?
It's gotta.
I think there's gotta be
you
an
go
Amtrak,
through
right?
Wilmington on the way to New York, right?
That sounds right.
That would be my only perfect point of reference. Train through country? Is that a thing? Flyover country?
Whatever. Give him a second term and we'll have those trains out there.
Dan's going to yell at us now for making fun of Delaware.
He's running for Senate there. All right, Max, thanks for stopping by. And we'll check in with you as the trial continues.
Great.
Thanks to Max Fisher for joining. And we will talk to you on Thursday. Love it. You want to join the pod?
Sounds like he doesn't, John.
Yeah. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our senior producer is Andy Gardner-Bernstein. Our producers are Haley Muse and Olivia Martinez. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis sound engineered the show. Thanks to Hallie Kiefer, Ari Schwartz, Sandy Gerard, Andy Taft, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montu. Our episodes are uploaded as videos at youtube.com/podsaveamerica.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.